All right, we'll get started because I know we're quite short for time. So welcome to those who have come along. My name's Andrew Smith. I'm going to be chairing. Today we've got two scheme updates. First, I'll introduce Rick Howe. Rick is going to be talking about the WA CTP scheme. So Rick was appointed as the Deputy Chief Executive to ICWA, Insurance Commission of WA, in 2015. You've held a number of executive and leadership positions across the insurance sector and the banking sector over many years. I won't go into how many years, but very well credentialed to talk to us today. A degree in mechanical engineering from the University College in London, and current role, Rick oversees has overseen the successful expansion of the scheme in WA to include no-fault lifetime care, and I'm sure that you'll probably touch on that during the course of today. And Paul Kingston next to me, I'll introduce Paul after Rick's finished speaking. So we'll go for about 15 minutes, 5 minutes of questions, and then we'll hand over to Paul.
Okay, so thank you, Andrew, and hopefully I can make the technology do what it's meant to. Appreciate you taking the effort to come and find the smallest room for the presentations tucked in the corner, so hopefully we'll make it worthwhile. I just want to basically spend 10-15 minutes running through how we've gone, obviously, over the last 12 months or so with our scheme in WA, but many of you will be aware of the fact that we've introduced some change as a result of adapting to the NIIS. But just for the benefit of those who are not familiar with the way the schemes are set up in WA, our motor injury insurance scheme is government-owned and self-funded trading enterprise, but we are a monopoly provider and we are the underwriter in the scheme for both lifetime care and for the old CTP fault-based scheme for the state. We insure around 2.9 million registered vehicles, which actually gives us an interesting ratio in relation to the population that we have, which is considerably less than the number of vehicles that we have. The Insurance Commission has been responsible for administering the Third Party Insurance Fund for many, many decades. 1949 it came into existence. The Catastrophic Injuries Fund came into effect on the 1st of July last year, and so we're reporting for the first time on how that's gone. Starting with the old scheme, the CTP scheme, just looking at some of the data. Over the last 7 or so years, we've grown in terms of liabilities from around $1.6 billion in 2010 to $2.6 billion nearly last year. We've maintained a funding ratio or solvency sitting around the sort of 130s and approaching 140% on a regular basis, with the exception of 2012, where we had a little bit of a dip on the back of some rather interesting investment performance at that stage, as well as one of our lowest underwriting performances. But importantly, the scheme is relatively stable, relatively well-funded, and hasn't presented us with any major financial issues from that perspective. Looking at that claims experience, the overall history is fairly straightforward. We have been experiencing a reduction in claims over time for a considerable period. You can see that the overall outstanding claims have drifted down from around 7,000 going back to 2010 down to around 6,000 now. In fact, we've been under 6,000 for the last 3 years. The new claims that have come in have also drifted down, but I think worthy of observation is the performance in 2016-17. This graph only goes back to 2010, but if you look at our frequency going back for the previous decade, it has been on a continuous downward trend, both in frequency and, in fact, in claims numbers for that period. Last year, we saw an increase in both our claims numbers and our claims frequency for the first time. We're not quite sure what that means yet. 1 year doesn't really give you a lot to go on, but obviously we are watching cautiously to see whether that's simply a little blip in a continuous downward trend or whether in fact it's an indicator that perhaps we've reached some kind of plateau and may struggle to get those numbers down in future. This is the frequency numbers. The blue line is the vehicle growth. The orange line is the claims frequency. As you can see, the vehicle growth, particularly sort of from 2004 or so through to about 2012, annual growth figures well in excess of 3%, which explains why we have so many vehicles on the road these days. But you'll notice the last couple of years, reflective of the condition of the economy in WA, that's dropped off, although to some of the gloom and doom merchants, it has not gone negative. We have still had vehicle growth over that period of time. That last little blip on the orange line is the piece that I'm exercising caution around, and that, as I say, is the first time our frequency has lifted upwards for some considerable period, and so we're trying to make sure that we keep an understanding of what's happening in that space. Obviously, I've mentioned in the dot point there that harvested claims are potentially an issue for us. We have become conscious of what's happening in that space, and one of the pieces or indicators for us has been actually watching what's happened with eastern states' representation on claimants in WA for accidents that occurred in WA. And over the last couple of years, we've seen that grow from, albeit still small, we've had a doubling in each of the last 2 years of those numbers, from around 40 claims to around 100 claims to around 200 claims in the last year that fit into that category. So we're certainly very conscious of what's been going on. We're also looking carefully at what's happened in New South Wales and trying to make sure we understand whether or not any actions that happen elsewhere might push the problem further afield, and try and remain vigilant in that space. With our premiums, one of the things that we've been very proud of over a number of years and heralded was the fact that we were able to run the scheme at a relatively low cost compared with others. And in fact, we had many years where we didn't have premium increases. Over the course of the last 5 years, we've had a policy to try and ensure that we exercise at least increases in line with AWE to try and avoid getting into a situation where any substantial claim increases or other premium increases are required as a result of things not going according to plan. The big jump you see in the actual bars there for the price, which is now sitting at around $420 per vehicle for their Class 1 family sedans, was obviously the introduction of the new scheme. We have one premium that people pay to cover their insurance for both the existing CTP scheme and the newly introduced catastrophic injury scheme. We only charge that one premium. We apportion the money between the two funds as required. But that was a $99 increase. In addition to that, we increased the standard premium base by 2.5% that year. So the actual increase was a little bit over $100. Last year, or the one that's just gone through, we put up by 2.8%, which matched AWE at that stage. average weekly earnings has dropped back considerably this year, but on top of that, we've made determination that we're probably not going to put a premium increase through for the next year, because we're now starting to look reasonably comfortable where we're at. So, moving on to the new scheme, which is the piece that's first reported now. This time last year, Fab Zanutish, for those of you who are here to listen, would have said we've started the scheme and we've no idea what's happening because we hadn't seen anything at that stage of the proceedings. We are now 15 months into the scheme, and frankly, we probably still have no idea what's happening, given that that doesn't give us very much history, but we do at least have some numbers to be able to report. So when we set the scheme up for the no-fault component, we were anticipating 42 participants during the course of the year. Pleased to report that our actual participation has been lower than expected. So we've ended up with 32 out of that 2016-17 accident year, one of whom has actually been suspended. They were able to return to New Zealand and so have moved out of our scheme. And thank you, ACC, for picking them up. looking at the locations and some of the things that we were anticipating, we've had 50% of those no-fault accidents occur in regional areas. Any of you who are any good at demographics will understand that the population split in WA is roughly 80% in the metro area and 20% in the regional areas. And so that's obviously a very significant skew, but is not all that far out of line with what we were anticipating, given the propensity for the distances in WA to result in regional areas having a high number of single vehicle runoff road accidents. And we don't have a lot of crash barriers on the thousands of kilometres of road that we've got, but we do have a lot of trees, and that's not a very good mix. So we're obviously keeping an eye on that. It has a significant impact in terms of the service delivery for us that we need to contemplate. Down at the bottom there, there's a few basic stats that tell you that most of those people are drivers. We've got the usual rash of motorcyclists in there, a couple of pedestrians, and one person from an ordinary push bike. Our split between acquired brain injuries and spine injuries is roughly as we were expecting. We were certainly expecting the majority to be from ABIs. The proportion is actually just slightly higher than we were originally anticipating, but certainly well in line with statistical expectations in that space. Gender, also potentially not surprising for anybody who's familiar with road accident victims. 26 of the 32... in our no-fault scheme were male, and if you have a look at the age demographic, it also probably doesn't surprise you that we've got a big chunk there in the 15 to 24 age group drifting off towards the end. Perhaps of significance from a financial point of view, whilst the overall numbers in the 55-plus age group category are not that significant, the skew within that age group is very much younger than we thought it would be, and there are more participants there than we were expecting, which has introduced a slightly different take on what our expenses are likely to look like. For the ABIs, the overall scenario for all of our accidents has been that the actual severity of the injuries that we're dealing with is, broadly speaking, a little bit worse than we were anticipating. So whilst we've had fewer participants, they have generally been more seriously injured, and the age groups within the cohorts that we're looking at have been skewed slightly younger, all of which leads to a higher cost. And when we look at the spinal injuries, again, the numbers are very low. If you have a look at most of those yellow bars, which are the expected numbers, the vast majority of them are less than one, so it's very hard to have an injury of only part of a person. but obviously, as we go on, we'll start to get to the outcomes that we're looking at. But of significance, we've got two very high-level spinal injuries, which are clearly quite expensive. For what it's worth, we've looked at the payments that have been going out of the system. Clearly, as a lifetime support scheme, we expect the vast majority of the costs that we're incurring to be future payments. And for what it's worth, we ended up actually shelling out a total of around about $4.5 million during the course of the year, which is obviously a very small proportion of the total liabilities that we've taken on. Some of the challenges that we're dealing with... The high proportion of regional participants is significant for us, both in terms of some of the cultural challenges. Travel and access is significant. With our CTP scheme, we have, over the course of the last few years, got into the habit of sending a team of plaintiff lawyers, defendant lawyers, claims staff, and medical specialists on a road trip to the northwest and northeast of WA to sit under trees in remote communities and try and resolve some of these things. It's been a very successful exercise in trying to bring to a conclusion claims that have been around for a long time and to actually catch up with some of those participants. With the lifetime care arrangement, where we're not looking to settle schemes but instead trying to deliver services, that presents us with a slightly different challenge on how we go about dealing with that. We've had participants from overseas. We have the usual things you might deal with around language. drug and alcohol abuse is an issue potentially as well that we've already had to try and deal with, as well as dealing with both criminal histories or, more importantly, people facing charges in relation to the crash. We had one of our participants is currently in jail and will remain there for some time as a result of charges from the accident where he actually deliberately crashed his vehicle into another. We have spent a bit of time trying to understand, in particular, how we are going on the front of client satisfaction. As the administrator and underwriter of the CTP scheme for many years, we have had an involvement in paying the bills for people who were injured and ensuring that somebody organised care for them. But we haven't actually been involved in it ourselves until now. So from the 1st of July, with the advent of the new scheme, we have taken on board a new group of staff who are care coordinators, who are managing the cases and have brought in a very different skill set into the organisation, which has proved both beneficial to the participants but also to our old CTP scheme as well, in giving us a much sharper look at some of the benefits that we are paying for and whether or not we should be within that existing CTP scheme. But what's been helpful is overwhelmingly the feedback from the participants that we have had so far has been very positive. We've had some of the verbatims there that it's made quite a difference for people that we have adopted a model whereby our care coordinators meet with the treating health team, with the families and with the victims at the earliest opportunity, invariably whilst they're still in hospital, and actually lay out what their options are, what the process is, and help take them through that. And that has proved to be particularly helpful and appreciated by those participants. Which fundamentally brings me to the end of what I had to say. Effectively, we've got I'd like to describe a benign position at the moment. Financially speaking, we are sound. Underwriting performance has been solid. We've backed that up with some good investment performance, which has helped our solvency positions. And the introduction of the new scheme has run smoothly so far and uncontroversially. I hope it remains that way. Any questions? Yes.
Of the catastrophically injured clients, have the majority of those been able to return to their previous living environment?
Those that have moved on, yes, but we're still at a very early stage. So obviously a lot of the people that are in the scheme are still in the acute phase. They're either in rehab or still in hospital. But where people have moved on so far, the vast majority have moved home. As I said, we had an overseas participant from New Zealand, in fact, who wasn't able to return home when he was first out of hospital here and was in kind of a rehab and halfway house, but has chosen to return to New Zealand. So as a result of that, our arrangement is that we don't fund once they leave the country. But obviously with New Zealand having a scheme that entitles all residents to the benefits, they go straight into the ACC care instead.
Can I just ask people when they have a question just to identify themselves and if you don't feel like going up to the microphone, speak loudly because it is being recorded.
Leslie Anderson, new with the National Injured Insurance Agency Queensland, so I think we're 1 year old now. I suppose I'd wonder because we've got a similar common law settlement.
Yes.
I'm just wondering what you as an organisation is doing to actually try and lay some ground rule, because ideally it would be really good if our services from our care coordinators are so good that the people don't want to get their check.
We are wary of trying to lay out a desired outcome. We have conflicting views. From a financial perspective, it would be great to get the certainty they take their money and go, and that gets rid of our long-term liabilities.
No,
in our scheme, they don't come back. But equally, we want to make sure people are getting access to appropriate care, and we also think that we're able to provide that care at a cost that may prove to be less than the longer-term benchmarks that have been set in the CTP scheme. So, we're open either way, frankly, as to what they want. We won't have to deal with that yet. We have a minimum two-year period before we even assess lifetime eligibility for the scheme. And given when our first participants came in, we won't be looking at the first options there until sometime around about September next year. That's when it will probably first come into relief, and we'll have to look at whether or not there are people who want to take their money and go, or whether they're happy to remain in the scheme. Don?
Two questions, if I may. Don Fergus on Lifetime Care New South Wales. First is, with people in custody, do you retain liability? Are you providing these services to people while they're in custody?
Okay, on that one's fairly straightforward. Yes, we theoretically have some liabilities. However, the requirements to provide the care still fall with corrective services. And in the particular instance that we were dealing with, the only piece that we have had to fund beyond the care that was provided in the infirmary in the hospital was some physio sessions. So the actual expenses in relation to that case have been very minimal.
Thank you. Great to see the early focus on customer satisfaction. Is there some early thinking around outcome measurement as well at this stage?
There is. And I would describe it only as thinking. We are keen to try and ensure that we do get appropriate outcomes, and we are endeavouring to make sure that we're picking up reasonable data on what is going on. But at this point in time, we have, we only have people in the acute or the immediate care phase. And so to actually start trying to judge what those outcomes are is just, frankly, it's too early. We certainly want to be in a position to do that. As part of the legislation that set us up, we have a review to be undertaken after 5 years. And we want to try and make sure that we're able to provide some reasonable output evidence at that point in time.
Okay, maybe one more question. There's a question up the back.
Don just asked my question. How are you measuring outcomes?
Hugh Miller from Tenor Frame. You make a comment your CTP is generally tied to AWE, but you're not putting through an increase this year. I wonder if there's any more detail you could add about how you think about putting in increases.
I can. It's a fairly extensive debate that's been had. We take the notion that we need to make sure that the scheme is sustainable. And one of those, we also want to try and avoid shocks. What we don't want to do is run the scheme at a level whereby if we have a bad underwriting performance and we have a bad investment year that coincides, we're suddenly forced to whack the population with a great big increase to collect money. So we have been adopting a philosophy that allows us to increase premiums at a slow and steady rate in line with our costs, and AWE is the best guide for that. In WA, some of those numbers have looked quite strange by comparison with the rest of the country over the last few years. Yeah, I mean, we had AWE numbers of 6 and 8% going back a couple of years. Right now, the number's coming in pretty close to zero. there are some slightly different drivers in terms of what we look for there, but we take into account solvency in the fund. We're looking at what we think we are able to accommodate without actually having to hit people with dangerous increases. And so we're comfortable that this year we had a very, very good investment performance last year. We're able to absorb the cost and not put a premium increase in this time around, and we'll be okay.
All right. Thank you, Rick. We should draw it to a close there for Rick and let him sit down. So thank you very much. I'll quickly introduce Paul Kingston. Paul's the CEO of the Motor Accidents Insurance Board in Tasmania. Like Rick, Paul's held numerous executive roles in both public and private sector and a bit of a jack of all trades. Paul's been involved with government policy and advice, property development, ICT, outsourced service provisions and financial modelling. Been a director on numerous boards and holds a Bachelor of Economics with honours, postgraduate qualifications in management, and is a graduate of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. Please welcome Paul.
Thank you. From the geographically largest state to the smallest. But, I'd still argue, both very good schemes. I'll spend just a little bit of time for those that may not be aware of what our scheme is. I won't spend too much time going through the detail of what our scheme is and what our financial performance is. You can read our very brief and boring annual report if you wanted to go through that, which is up on our website. But just briefly for those that don't know too much about us, we are the CTP scheme in Tasmania. We've existed for 42 years, so we've got a long history and also build ourselves up in terms of funding capacity over many decades. We're a Tasmanian government-owned business, fully underwritten by the government. We provide true no-fault benefits, very similar to the TAC for those that are aware of that, with access still to common law. My chief operating officer is in the room, almost as much as the law will allow, but it is a fairly generous access to common law damages on top of our no-fault. And our lifetime care scheme, which we call Future Care, has been around for 26 years. So we're probably the other end of the scale of where Rick is, but where his scheme will end up over the next generation, Rick. Our coverage is really very broad, so it's anyone involved in a Tasmanian registered vehicle, anyone injured, private and public roads. There's no distinction for us. We obviously comply with the NIST standards. In fact, we did pretty much when they came in. We had to make a few very minor adjustments, but we complied from the get-go. And we have the usual minor exclusions around people doing stupid things that we don't cover, but they are very much in the minority. In terms of our statutory benefits, I won't go through these in details. You will notice that our statutory limit outside of our lifetime care scheme is $400,000, $500,000 if they've been hospitalised, and that might seem very low. Our medical costs in Tasmania are quite low and aren't experiencing, well, virtually no superimposed inflation, is our assessment for medical costs. So while that doesn't seem like a lot, it does cover the vast majority of our cases that aren't lifetime care. And our future care scheme is based on access being around needing 2 hours of care per day indefinitely. And that sounds like I must admit, when I first walked into this business, I was a bit worried about that would let anybody in that could have any sort of medical need on a small basis. But it's quite amazing that it does really cut to the chase to those people that need lifetime care and rules out those that don't. And the indefinite period is really the criteria that lets us separate those out. Just to give you an idea, after 26 years of operation of our lifetime care scheme, we have 100 people on the books, with probably about half of those not really active. So they are very small numbers for a small population, but they are still small in terms of what we have on our books. Common law, again, we have fairly good access. There really aren't any thresholds to bring a claim, very, very low level ones. We have some restrictions under the Civil Liability Act. They're fairly similar to a lot of other jurisdictions, a few little differences in terms of percentages. For us, common law, while it is a big financial issue for us, is not our number one focus. It's definitely a core focus for us, but it's not our number one focus, and that's primarily because with the lifetime care scheme and no fault taking largely medicals off the table, there really isn't a lot left in common law other than general damages and future economic loss. And we don't have, best way of putting it, as litigious society as perhaps some of the other states. So a lot of the claim farming, the heavy presence of plaintiff lawyers, we don't experience at the same level in Tasmania yet. It is something we're keeping our eye on, and there is leakage, as Rick was saying, but we are not in that same space that a lot of the other jurisdictions are having to face, which is good and enables us to focus on the care element from some of the discussions this morning rather than necessarily the adversarial nature that they can get into. Quickly on regulated pricing, for some reason our Act doesn't trust that I, as a government-owned monopoly, would set reasonable prices. I think we're fairly trustworthy. But just to prove it, we have an independent regulator who does all the pricing for all the government businesses in Tasmania. Every 4 years, we're reviewed to check our pricing is appropriate. We went through that process in the first half of this year. Really, the end result was pretty boring and not much change. So there was no general increase, and we haven't had a general increase. I think we've had one increase in the last 12 years. And in real terms, our premiums have reduced by over 50% over that period. So it's not like we're gouging extra pricing. Obviously, a regulator is looking at, are we actually passing on the pricing reductions that we're getting through our experience in a timely manner? We believe we are, but that's what one of the things that the regulator checks on. Basically, the final outcome was that our Class 1, our standard light vehicle premium, as at 1st of December, will be $294, which includes GST. That's lower than the level in 2002. So what we're experiencing is a slow contraction of our scheme. I'm being very successful at business by slightly decreasing the business to nothing. But we take, picking up on one of the questions earlier, we take our premium pricing to be that our premiums covers our costs. That's it. We're a no-profit model. Our profit should be zero every year, underwriting profit. Not always possible to do that, but as we have profits from reducing claim numbers, good investment experience, we pass that back. And likewise, if we needed to pass anything on, we would pass it back through increased premiums over time. Similar to Rick, we would not want very sort of up and down movements in premiums. It wouldn't be good politically to pass that on. It's not something we've experienced. As I said, we've decreased in real terms by about 50%. The actual nominal decrease has been 11.3% over those 12 years. So it's quite a mature scheme that's well funded, and our experience is decreasing, which is exactly where we want it to be. In terms of our claims management process, we do put a high focus on trying to put client service and excellent client service first. That's our mantra that we're trying to do. We manage basically every single claim. So unlike some of the bigger states that have bulk numbers, it's harder to touch every single claim. The size of the number of claims we have and the scale we have enables us to manage each one. Our future care, our lifetime support team, individually manage claims. So of those 50-odd claims that are active, we've got a team of about four or five people looking after them. So you can imagine that the claims ratio to claims officer is very, very low. And that does enable us to really work with them, their families and their communities about their best outcomes. So it's something that I think we've been focused on for a long time as a business. It's probably just not in people's terminology that that's what we're doing. The claims officers we've got have largely been here for decades. So I'm a newish CEO in the experience of MARB. I think we've only had about four or five in its existence. And our average, you know, our claims officers have been there for 20, 30, 40 years. So we have a wealth of experience and the outcomes of the patients and trying to get them back to their pre-injury status as quickly as possible, even our catastrophically injured clients, is exactly what we do focus on and continue to do. We outsource most of our work. Similar, we're a funder. We're not a medical provider, but we do work closely with our various allied health and health professionals to make sure we give the right services. I won't go through our claims numbers too much in the interests of time, but we are continuing a downward trend in our claims. So our claims frequency is now down to, in fact, it's just dipped under 5 per 1,000 vehicles, and going back 5-10 years, it was getting up above 6. So we've had a very good reduction and steady reduction over that time. Our average claim payments are reducing as well. So we're actually reducing not only in number and frequency, but also average claim costs. And we continue, it was interesting the discussions today about return to work. We've been very much heavily focused on return to work and rehabilitation for our clients in terms of their work life, including our lifetime care patients, which probably going back some years we weren't as focused on, but now is something that we continue to try to offer. They're just charts of everything going down and looking good. That's what I give to the board and our owners. That's all they need to see. Our financial position, getting to our owners. So obviously our two biggest performance drivers in terms of a business are our investment income. So we do our own investment, so we manage that. We use asset consultants and individual fund managers, but we manage that within the business. And we have a business of about 34-35 FTE. So to be able to manage the investment side of it in-house is a good achievement. And obviously our claims liability and expenses the other side. We have a funding ratio not dissimilar to WA, so our target range is 120 to 145. We're sitting right in the middle of it, which is good to report to everybody, that we're not taking too much money from premiums and we're giving enough back to the government, but not too much. Our outcomes for 16-17 were very strong financially, so we had a very good net profit. All our KPIs in terms of return on assets and equity were met. We had an underwriting result, which is probably not, it's too high for what we'd want. Coming back to our aim is to get towards zero. So that would suggest that if our trends keep on going, that there'll be further pressure for premiums to reduce over the next few years. The regulator enables us, very similar to Western Australia, to increase by a WOTI in each of the 3 years between our reviews. So while we have that capability, the reality is that there's more downward pressure on our premiums than anything else unless we have dramatic change. The two things I did want to focus on quickly were the two key aspects that I was asked to focus on when I came into this role. The first one of those is to actually, the first time I've run a business where the whole aim is to not have a business in the future. We're very heavily into looking after road safety and funding road safety initiatives. We're not quite the TAC. We don't have road safety policy responsibilities in our bailiwick, but we fund all the activities in the state. So we fund the entire Tasmanian Police Road Safety Division, so 16 officers on the road are funded by us, and we do the education campaigns around road safety. We also fund a range of other road safety and community-based activities across the state. So one of the things that we do take seriously is being a social insurer. So the stat I like producing, which works well in Tasmania with these small numbers, just multiply by about 10 or 20 if you're in another state. It costs about just under $6 million to run my business, and we give away $5.5 million in funding and grants and other components. Now, for any business to do that, that's not a bad effort. I want to try to tip it over, so I've got to save a few costs going forward and find a few more things to fund. But we do take seriously that our whole job is to make sure that we don't have clients in the future. We want to look after them very well when they're with us, but we don't want them to start with. And the other aspect for the MOB, sounds like a wonderful success story with everything going in the right direction. We have a lot of inbuilt corporate knowledge from our long-serving staff. The thing we do have to do is modernise ourselves and be ready for whatever the next challenge is. There are challenges on the horizon already. We've talked about some of them today already around autonomous vehicles and other technological and regulatory changes. The pressures, market pressures from things like NIS, and also given we look after investments, the current investment environment is not conducive to extremely strong returns as we've experienced in the past. So what we're trying to focus on inside the organisation is to basically create an organisation that's a bit more adaptable and used to change and ready to take those challenges when they come on board, because one of the disadvantages of being a very stable long-term business is that we struggle to be able to meet challenges when they come along because we're not adaptable. So that's been a big cultural change issue that I've been driving through the organisation over the last 12 months. I think that was it. So open for questions.
Perfect timing. We've probably got about 2 minutes before we get kicked out to rotate two different rooms. So question at the back. Don't forget to identify yourself.
Very basically and not very progressively, to be brutally honest. We have a client, an annual, well, actually, when I took it over, we had a client survey every 2 years, which we used to take. And we score very well in. I've at least moved that to annual. That's been one of the big changes I've implemented in my time there. But we haven't actually really defined those outcomes. So I think like everybody else, we're grappling to say what is the outcome and how would you actually measure it. And as I said, I think a lot of our staff are really focused on helping clients because they're working on with them and their families one-on-one. If I asked them about outcomes, they'd say, I'm looking after the client. You know, it's inbuilt to what they do, but how we measure that and how we make it consistent moving forward, not just depending on the claims officer, I think we need to tap into some of those measures and broader measures and impact in the community, which I think we inherently have in our staff, but we're not actually even defining, let alone measuring it. It is something we're trying to work towards to put a bit more challenge to the staff to think a bit broader than even their most core object, which is looking after the client.
Do they have like a holistic plan at all?
No. Look, we do. We have a supports needs assessment, which actually does take in all the aspects of the claimant's life. So we actually do have some reasonably good care and what care packages and an understanding of what we're meant to provide in our scheme. Going beyond the actual individual claimant and their family and their injury, no, that's pretty much where it stops. At some of the factors we've been talking about already around bigger social impacts, that's a difficult bow for our staff to see at the moment, but something we're trying to stretch them to.
Yeah. Tony, I've also from the TAC. I'm interested with your external regulators setting your pricing every 4 years. What about the impact of the NDIA and their pricing? Is that proving to be a challenge?
Not at this stage. So we went out for tender for our attendant care services earlier this year and reset the price. We knew what the NDI price was, so we know we're in the market. And we're a big purchaser in a state of the size of Tasmania, so scale probably helps us a little bit. But that has not been an issue that we've experienced. So there's no superimposed inflation in our future care scheme at all. The actuaries do not allow for anything, and we haven't observed any for a long time. But that will most likely change.
I might push quickly one more question here.
Oh, I'll take it offline, I guess, but it's really about
your
purpose-built houses.
Yes.
And whether your recent claimants think that's a good idea,
because
obviously it's a big
one. Yeah, no, they're all under capacity by a long way because people are going back to their homes. So we also modify homes for people to get back to, so that's more the modern... Yes, yeah, but we hold on to them because there are people that just don't have family structures to go back to, but they're under capacity, which is what we want.
All right, please join me in thanking Rick and Paul.